be back to PI and to enjoy this great atmosphere and work with people here. So today I'd like to talk about some recent work that I did together with Toby Kiewit, who is a Royal Society Fellow in the University of Cambridge, which is about characterizing and, in fact, somehow fully characterizing in the sense that we give sufficient and necessary conditions, universal Hamiltonian simulators. So I hope I'll make that clear throughout the talk. So for that, I'd like to start talking about complexity. So as you know, we are surrounded by many systems which are very complicated to describe, such as, of course, in physics and chemistry, we encounter lots of these problems, like describing materials, electrons in materials, or other kinds of phenomena, many body systems in general, or, of course, also neurons in a brain, where the complexity stems more from the size of the system than number of variables and the interaction pattern than from the complexity of each of its constituents. So somehow we want to understand emergent phenomena. So despite the fact that we may understand each neuron, this does not imply that we understand how the brain works. Or I'm just giving some other examples. So for example, economical systems, again, we have very complicated scenarios with local agents wanting to maximize some local cost functions, say like the own gain, and we want to predict how the entire system will evolve. Or say ecosystems, where again, we have very many different kinds of agents, like different kinds of animals who want to optimize against some local function, like say their own food supply. And you want again predict how the dynamics or how where this is going to. And one way of tackling with all these complex systems is to take a somewhat bottom-up approach, where one can build a model which is simple enough to handle so that you can make some predictions and you understand it from first principles, so to say, but of course also rich enough to capture some of the relevant phenomena that you want to study. And one family of such toy models are classical spin models, which are the focus of this talk. So what I mean by a classical spin model is a model which is defined by some classical degrees of freedom, and in where a cost function, which depends on this configuration of variables, is defined. So a cost function is what in physics we call a Hamiltonian, and of course it's simply a function from a configuration of variables to a real number. And of course these classical degrees of freedom can have, say, q levels for any q, any natural q. And this cost function should specify, for example, the k-body interactions among the variables, so for any k, for any natural k, and the type of these interactions, for example, Ising type or Potts type or other more complicated types. And it should also specify the coupling strength, of course, so which is essentially like a scale of the energies of each local term. And it should also specify the interaction pattern, meaning which particle interacts with which other. So I'm saying this to illustrate that this is a very general definition which encompasses a very broad class of models. And to illustrate that, I will focus on one particular feature here, which is the interaction pattern. So the interaction pattern could be associated to a graph, for example, in which case there are various ways of doing so. So one of them is, as is done for vertex models, where the variables are associated to edges and the interactions to vertices. So of course, this is very convenient if you want to describe many-body interactions, right? Because so, for example, for this particular graph, which is a 2D square lattice, variables participate in four-body interactions. But of course, the limitation is that each edge has two ends. So each variable will only be able to participate in two many-body interactions. And these models were devised to describe ice-type models and things of this kind. Or you can use the graph in another way, namely as it stands for edge models, where you put your variables on the vertices and use your edges as representations of interactions. But these interactions are always two-body. This is the limitation of this picture. But this is, of course, very convenient to describe certain ferromagnetic materials and was introduced for this purpose. Or you can use it in yet another way. So, for example, as it's done in lattice gauge theories, where you put your variables on the edges and interactions on the faces. So these faces are always for body, because the interaction is on the face no matter what the dimension of this square lattice is. And this was introduced, again, for another reason. So as gauge theories on the, to put gauge theories on the lattice, or also to study spin models with local symmetries, and, but yet a non-trivial phase diagram. So again, so to emphasize, to continue emphasizing the variety of models that you can consider in this family, this may not be enough. And you may need to use a hypergraph, where you represent variables as certain dots, certain elements of a set, and interactions are subsets of these variables. Okay, like, and you can draw them this way. Or equivalently with a factor graph, which is something that I recently learned from a book by Marc Mézard and Andrea Montanari, where they use two different kinds of vertices, ones for variables and ones for interactions, and these two pictures are equivalent. So, well, if you look carefully, you will see that they are indeed equivalent, okay? So the interaction vertices are the red squares here. Okay, and again, these graphs can be irregular or regular of any dimension, and so on. So the message here, what I'm trying to say is that classical spin models are a broad and versatile class, which can be used for different complex systems. So among others, the ones I mentioned at the very beginning, with different degrees of success for the different complex systems, but they are a tool. And just to clarify it for the sake of this talk, when I say a spin model, I will mean a family of Hamiltonians that are related in some way. For example, if I say the 2D Ising model with fields, I will mean the set of all Ising models defined on a 2D square lattice of any size with some coupling strength and some fields, which I generally take to be inhomogeneous. Okay? So this is an infinite family parametrized by, in this case, the size of the square lattice, the collection of coupling strengths, and the collection of fields. Okay, so there's some parameter that allows me to index the elements in that family. Okay? But otherwise, when I say a spin model, I mean a pretty, somehow a coherent family. I don't mean anything, any possible Hamiltonian. And I want to ask the question, what do these models have in common? Or whether it is possible to learn something about the physics of a particular family of spin models if you know about the physics of some other family of spin models, or if they are totally unrelated. And this brings me to the notion of Hamiltonian simulation. So I say that a Hamiltonian H simulates a Hamiltonian H prime if there exists a choice of parameters of H, meaning, again, H is, in fact, a family of, so it's a Hamiltonian of a certain spin model, and a spin model is a family, okay? So I can tune certain parameters in this family. And the point is that I will say that H simulates H prime if I can tune the parameters of H so that the low energy spectrum of H equals the spectrum of H prime, and the eigenstates of H prime are reproduced in a subset of the eigenstates of H. Okay, so let me first comment on the first point. So what this means is, of course, and I'm assuming that H is defined on a larger system size than H prime. That's why I say that the low energy spectrum equals the entire spectrum of H prime. And the second thing is, okay, I'm talking about eigenstates, which is trivial classically, but it's by default, I guess. But what I mean is that the state with energy E sub k of H prime is found in a subset of the state with the same energy of H. So it's not only the number, so the energy, which are the same, but also the state itself is reproduced in H. Okay, and of course this notion is trivial if H is more general than H prime, because of course I could take H to be the 3D Ising model and H prime the 2D Ising model. And by definition of how I define spin model, I could choose the 3D Ising model, so all the couplings in the 3D Ising model, which are not in a certain plane, to be zero, and all the magnetic fields to be zero. And that's precisely the 2D Ising model. So in this case, I don't even need an enlargement. But it,
you're not satisfied if the low energy spectrum of H contains other states that are not in the spectrum of hate crime? Right? So if there are states in the middle that are not...
No, I'm not satisfied.
You want that there's a threshold below which it's just equal
exactly.
to hate crime. Okay.
Exactly. And we put the threshold delta.
And below that threshold, it will be exactly like H prime, apart from the auxiliary spins of H. Yes. Okay. So as I said, this is non-trivial if H is more restrictive somehow than H prime. And I am putting the additional complexity somehow in the additional size of H. I will elaborate a little more on that. So what I'm trying to say here is, consider a Hamiltonian simulator H, and what I want is to put the parameters in this family of Hamiltonians so that its low energy physics equals the Hamiltonian H prime, or for other choices of parameters, say it equals the Hamiltonian H double prime. So in some sense, I am looking for a fine-graining procedure that I can apply on H prime and H prime prime so that it brings me back to one common Hamiltonian. So if you want, it's somehow like a renormalization into the ultraviolet somehow. And additionally, I require that the number of parameters needed to specify H and the number of spins where H acts are polynomially larger only than those of H prime and H prime prime. Okay, so just like with the notion of computation, where you have certain computers or certain machines that can compute certain functions, and then you have the notion of universal computation, where certain machines can compute any function or any Boolean function, we can define here the notion of universal Hamiltonian simulators, simply as Hamiltonian simulators which can simulate any other model, so any other H prime. So something like a Hamiltonian H for which there always exists a choice of parameters such that its low energy spectrum equals the spectrum of any target model, like here, I don't know, H prime and so on. You can go on with more and more primes. So again, I'm imagining a fine-graining procedure which brings all these different models to a common one. And of course, the non-trivial issue here is that these models could be very complex, meaning containing many body interactions or being defined on many dimensions, containing many body interactions or long-range interactions or Q-level spins. And this one is apparently simpler in the sense that it has a fixed dimension, it has simple and short-range interactions, it has two-level spins. But this additional complexity is encoded in the additional size here, which should be polynomially larger, and in the inhomogeneous couplings that I have set in this H. And of course, we know that these Hamiltonians themselves belong to different universality classes somehow. So if you apply a coarse-graining procedure and look at the low energy physics, then you will see that some of them may behave similarly at criticality, which I mean, they belong to the same universality class and characterized by certain critical exponents and so on. And this fine-graining procedure really should apply to all models, like models from different universality classes. And the main result of this work and the message I want to get across today is this one, that we give sufficient and necessary conditions for a classical Hamiltonian to be a universal Hamiltonian simulator. And these conditions are that its ground state energy problem is NP complete. It is we require slightly more than that, and I will explain the two slightly more technical points that we require, but this is the essential idea.
And the same thing with quantum works as well, or
I don't know.
Okay,
so to present this work, I first need to present some prelude on computational complexity, classical computational complexity, of course, of problems related to classical spin models. And then I will present this main result, which is this characterization of universal Hamiltonian simulators. This will be just one slide. And then I hope to give you an idea of the proof. I hope this doesn't get too technical. And finally, I will summarize. So there's really just one message in this talk. Okay. So there are many problems that you can define as related to the to classical spin models, but of course the most famous one and probably physically relevant one is the ground state energy problem, which is defined as follows. Given a classical spin model, meaning a family of models, again, with a certain Hamiltonian H, consider this problem. So the input of the problem is a constant K and a Hamiltonian H. And the output should it's a yes or no answer, so it's a decision problem. It should be yes if H has an energy state with energy below K, and no otherwise. So essentially, you're asking, does H has an energy state with energy below K? Yes or no? And you can ask things like, how hard is it to compute the answer? So meaning, if you feed K and H to a machine, and this machine has to give you yes or no, how many resources will this machine need? But okay. And of course, the most important class or most basic class in this context is the class P, which is the class of problems which can be solved on a classical and deterministic polynomial time Turing machine. But sometimes it's very hard to determine what is how hard it is to compute an answer, because sometimes you may come up with an algorithm and this may provide you an upper bound on the complexity of that problem, but it's very hard to provide lower bounds, like to say all algorithms will be at least that hard. Instead, it might be that you can answer another question, which is, how hard is it to verify a candidate answer? So here the scenario is different. So you have K and H, and you feed it not to a machine, but to a wizard, Wizard Merlin, usually. And he is not a machine. So he comes up with an answer from some magical powers, say yes or no, and usually sends it to King Arthur. But King Arthur doesn't trust Merlin and wants to verify this answer. So he would feed this answer and a certificate to a machine, which should accept or reject the answer. Now you can define very many classes with this scenario. But again, the most famous and important one is NP, which is the class of problems for which if the answer is yes, then there exists a certificate which is easy to verify, meaning which you can feed to a polynomial time machine and which will accept with certainty. And if the answer is no, then all certificates will be rejected. Now, of course, the class of problems which are easily computable is included in the class of problems which are easily verifiable. But whether or not the inclusion is strict is one of the most important open questions. But my point here is that the ground state energy problem of all classical spin models is in NP. So it is efficiently verifiable for any classical spin model, because you can just take the spin configuration as your certificate. Interestingly, for some problems, it is also NP hard, meaning it is at least as hard as any problem in NP. And the intersection between these two sets is called NP complete. So these are problems in NP which are somehow the hardest problems in the class. For example, the paradigmatic example is the 2D Ising model with fields, as shown by Barahona, which is here defined. It's important for this talk. I guess you've all seen it. But the Hamiltonian is defined here. So you have spins, two-level spins. Let's take them to take values 1 and minus 1. And you take the type of interaction is Ising type. So you take the product. So you look at the parity of these two spins. And there's a certain strength in that interaction. And then you have some local magnetic fields as well. And in general, I consider always inhomogeneous couplings, as you can see in here. So this problem is in here, is NP complete. And I want you now to consider another problem, the most famous one, in some sense the mother of all NP complete problems, which is the SAT problem, which is also NP complete, as was shown like in the 70s by Cook and Levin. So this problem is defined like this. So your input is a Boolean formula, so a function from Boolean variables to just one Boolean variable, so yes or no, so one or zero. And the output is yes if there is an assignment x such that the formula is true, so the formula is 1, and no otherwise. So essentially, you're asking, is the formula satisfiable? You're not asking, is x a satisfying assignment. You're just asking, is the formula satisfiable at all? Okay. And a very important notion in all this basic computational complexity theory is that of a polynomial reduction. So because the two problems are NP-complete, there exists a polynomial reduction from SAT to the ground state energy problem of, well, of any ground state energy problem, in fact, because they're all NP, but of this one here, which is the one of the 2D Ising model with fields, which means that I can transform this problem into this problem in a way that the my formula here, phi, will be satisfiable if and only if my Hamiltonian here will have an energy state with energy below k. And of course, h and k will be given by the original Boolean formula and will be defined in general on polynomially more variables. Now, for this work, we have defined a somehow stronger notion of polynomial reduction, which we call faithful polynomial reduction, which means that it's not only a polynomial reduction, but it also preserves the structure of the witness or of the certificate. Meaning, imagine that phi is satisfiable. Then the satisfying assignment maps to a satisfying state, meaning a state with energy below k, or at least to a subset of a state with energy below k. Because of course, this mapping will introduce additional variables, but I need somehow that the structure of this certificate is preserved in the mapping. So this is what I call a faithful polynomial reduction. Yes. No.
I mean, if the change, okay, if it is computable, I could allow for that, I think. I could modify it. I imagine that it's the inversion of all of them. It wouldn't be hard to, like the negation of all variables. It wouldn't be hard, I guess, to modify the construction, but I don't think it wouldn't bring anything new. But I really need that the structure is preserved somehow.
Okay. Okay, so with that, I've said enough to present the main result of this work, which is just this one slide. So we show that a spin model is a universal Hamiltonian simulator if and only if its ground state energy problem is NP-complete. Well, let me say it more precisely. We require, in fact, two things. First, we require that there exists a faithful reduction from SAT to its ground state energy problem. So of course, if it is NP-complete, there exists a reduction from SAT to its ground state energy problem. But it's not guaranteed that there exists a faithful reduction. So this is the additional condition that we require. And the second one is that it is closed, which means that if two Hamiltonians are in the model, their sum is also in the model. So it's something like, imagine that you have, so remember, a model is a family of Hamiltonians. And say I have an element of this family acting on spins A and B, and another member of the family acting on spins A and C, and I take their sum, A and B and C. Then I need that this new Hamiltonian is also in the family. So if my model places no constraints on the interaction pattern, then this is trivially true. But if it does, then it's not so obvious that this is true. Because, for example, for the 2D Ising model, imagine that I have a 2D Ising model defined between spins A and B, and another one between spins A and C. And if I take the sum, I may get a non-planar graph, which is not a 2D square lattice. To show that this is closed, I must be able to show that this can be transformed into a 2D square lattice. I will say a little bit more about that later. And as a corollary, we obtain that the 2D Ising model with fields is a universal Hamiltonian simulator. So let me give you the idea of the proof. So we want to show the theorem that I just showed you before.
Sorry. At first you said you want to show that the spin model is a universal Hamiltonian simulator if and only if the problem is NP-hard, is NP-complete. And then
I said I was cheating a little bit. Maybe I didn't say it, but
I wanted to say it. I said I'm simplifying things a little bit at the beginning, because in fact we need a little bit more. We need these two conditions. This is the real story. No, it's not just MP complete. I'm sorry, I didn't want to confuse you. I just wanted to get the first message across and then the real one somehow. So this is the real message. Okay?
Where is the MP
at? Yes.
So it's not only a reduction, but it's a faithful reduction.
Yes. Okay. So I'd like to give you an idea of the proof. So first, this direction. Well, that's the easy one. Because if it is, you can just take the 2D Ising model with fields. So if a spin model is a universal Hamiltonian simulator, then in particular, it can simulate the 2D Ising model with fields. And now, the traditional proof that its ground state energy problem is NP complete is also includes also a faithful reduction. I guess it's a natural thing to ask for somehow, this faithful reduction. So the traditional proof going from SAT to vertex cover and from vertex cover to ground state energy problem, they are themselves faithful. So the satisfying assignment here maps to a subset of the ground state energy, to the ground state of the final problem. And then to show that it is closed, this is what I just said before. It's not so immediate, but it's also easy to see. The problem is, as I said before, that the sum of two Hamiltonians may not be a 2D square lattice any longer. It may be, for example, a non-planar graph. So you have to make sure that you can recast that into a 2D square lattice. So what you can do is you can use a crossing gadget that was invented in a paper in the 70s by the authors of this book called Many NP Complete Problems, I think Gary and Johnson. Where they reduce vertex cover to planar vertex cover. So they manage to replace each crossing by a planar graph, which has lots of ferromagnetic interactions in there. Ferromagnetic interactions which are very strong, so which give a very strong penalty if the two spins are not aligned. So which in the end means that in the low energy sector that you will be interested in, the two spins will always be aligned. So this somehow allows you to propagate the information. This is the rough idea. And allows you to transform this non-planar graph into a 2D square lattice. So the message here is an example of this of a model here is the 2D Ising model with fields. And this universal Hamiltonian simulator must be able to simulate the 2D Ising model with fields. So this shows this reduction. OK, so the interesting part is how to see that these conditions are also enough for Hamiltonian to being a universal Hamiltonian simulator. So first, we will use closure only once. In particular, we will take the target Hamiltonian and express it as a sum of local terms, well, k local for any k, so we don't lose any generality. And we will prove the Hamiltonian simulation for one term in this sum. And finally, we will argue that since we can do Hamiltonian simulation for each term, we can also do Hamiltonian simulation for the sum. And then we will use the faithful reduction three times from SAT, which is what I want to show you next. To make it clear from the beginning, this can always be made so that the resulting Hamiltonian has ground state energy zero and a gap at least one. And as I said before also, of course, this reduction will always introduce the additional spins, which will play somehow an important role here. OK, so before telling you the faithful reductions, I need to set up some basics and some notation, which is that first take the canonical basis for Boolean functions on k bits. So just as you can see here. So it goes from k bits to 1 bit in a way that the ith function is 1 even only if the argument is I, and it is 0 otherwise. For example, take k equals 2 and x equals 3. Okay, so sometimes I write the in natural version of a number or the Boolean string version of a number. They are equivalent. Right, so x equals 3 would be the configuration 1 comma 0. Okay, so for this case, we have four functions. And so e1 of 3 is 0 because 1 is different from 3. e2 of 3 is 0 for the same reason. And the only one which is 1 will be the 3. Okay, so this will give you somehow a flag for the state of the argument. And then expand the Hamiltonian, the target Hamiltonian, so the Hamiltonian that we want to simulate in this basis. So obviously, remember that our Hamiltonian has only one term, only one k-body term by assumption. So of course you need to know the spectrum of this one k-body term. So this is here it is. Ei of Ei of x. Of course, this will only be 1 for x equals to I. Okay, and we will use the XOR operation repeatedly, the exclusive OR operation, which we denote with this circle dot, and which is just the negation of the addition modulo 2, and you can see here the truth table. But what I want you to remember is that it is 1 even only if A equals B. So if you do A XOR B, it's like asking, is A equal to B? Yes, 1, or no, 0. OK, so with that, I can present the first faithful reduction. So this force is the flag spin to say in which configuration the physical spins are. OK, let me explain that. So consider this formula in here, Ei of sigma s. So sigma s are the physical spins. So they will be a subset of spins in H. This is the subset I was requiring at the beginning, that it would reproduce also the eigenstates. So they will be in the state so they will be the eigenstate of H prime, if you want, okay? And this will be precisely this sigma s in here. Okay, so I consider this Boolean formula. Ei of sigma s, XOR sigma of bi. So remember, this Boolean formula is true, is equal to 1, even only if this one equals this one. So anyway, so I use a reduction. So far, it's only a reduction, which says that this formula is satisfiable if and only if a Hamiltonian that comes up from this construction that I call H1 has a ground state energy, has a ground state with zero energy. But I can say more because the reduction is faithful. So I can also say that if this is satisfiable, then the satisfying assignment, which will be the one that verifies the formula, so for which the formula is 1, will map to the ground state configuration of H1. So this ground state configuration will be given by the satisfying assignment and the auxiliary spins in some particular configuration. So the satisfying assignment is this thing here. Remember, this is 1 even only if this equals this. So this is this thing here. And the additional spins, I'm calling them A sub I, they will need to be in some subset, in some set of configurations. So there may be more than one choice. This is typically the case. So from now on, I will write it this way. I will say satisfying assignment maps to ground state configuration. For example, this is a running example throughout the proof. Take sigma s equals 3, okay, the state of the physical spins here. Now, the satisfying assignment will have this. This is what I call the flag spin, sigma bi. So in the satisfying assignment, this will be equal to this by assumption. So sigma b1 will be equal to e1 of 3, which will be equal to 0, because this is the result of this function. Sigma b2 will be e2 of 3, which will be 0. Sigma b3, which will be 1. And for 4, 0. Okay. Now, in the spin model, this looks like this. So we have some physical spins, these two, which are the subset whose state is equal to the state of H prime. So my second requirement in the definition of Hamiltonian simulation. Okay, and then I use some additional spins, and I am not assuming any particular kind of interaction or interaction pattern, etc. I'm only assuming that I can do a faithful reduction. Okay, so a subset of spins here for the term with I equals 1. Okay, so this comes from H1 of I equals 1. And one spin here is my flux spin sigma B1, which in the ground state configuration, will be equal to E1 of sigma S, which is 0. And in the ground state configuration, sigma of A1 is in sigma of A1. Okay. Now I also need to apply to I equals 2. So this is the result somehow, or this is the mapping of I equals 2 to H1 of I. Sorry, I should have written here an additional I. So for each I have a certain Hamiltonian H1 of I. So I have here a sigma of A2 being in a set big sigma of A2 and a flux spin in the state 0. And now for I equals 3, I will always denote it in this color red. And my flux spin will be in 1 in the ground state configuration. And for 4, it will be in 0. Okay, very well. Now, if I knew that my H had local magnetic fields, I could just now assign a local magnetic field to this flux spin with the energy of EI. So imagine that I could use local magnetic fields, and I could say this, I assign to this energy E1, to this energy E2, to this energy E3, and to this energy E4. Then since this will be multiplied by 0, by 0, by 1, by 0, this will give me precisely energy E3, which is the energy of this configuration. So I would be done. But I cannot assume that I have local magnetic fields. So this is why I need the following two steps, following two faithful reductions. OK. So, and of course, non-satisfying assignments here map to excited states of H1. Okay, and just to tell you why I'm doing this, or what does this do on the final Hamiltonian, after each faithful reduction, I'll try to tell you, yes, what role this is playing. So the first faithful reduction plays the role of ensuring that the flux spin is correct. So in particular, of course, I will multiply this Hamiltonian here by a delta, which is this threshold, above which I don't care what happens in H, but which defines what is my low energy sector and my high energy sector, if you want. And what will happen is this. So consider the term I equals to 1. So I always have this running example where the physical spins are in state 3. So I take I equals to 1, which is different from 3. And now I look at the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. This is what? So the states with energy 0 are those for which sigma of P1 is 0, and sigma of A1 is in a certain set of states, sigma of A1. And all other states have energy above delta, because I have rescaled it with this delta. Now, for the term with I equals 3, the ground state will be given by sigma of B3 equals 1, and sigma of A3 in this set. And all other states will have energy above 0. OK. But now I need to give the flux spin with energy 1 the energy E3, the energy of the target Hamiltonian. So this is the purpose of the second faithful reduction, which forces the flux spin to be in 0. And if it is in 1, it is in a certain excited state. So in this case, the formula, so forcing the flux spin to be in 0 corresponds to this formula, sigma bi xor 0. And this formula is satisfiable if and only if another Hamiltonian, H2 of I, if you want, has ground state with 0 energy. This is the reduction, but I want to use the faithful reduction, in which case the satisfying assignment, which is sigma bi equals 0, right? The two have to be the same in order for the formula to be 1, maps to the ground state configuration, where sigma bi is 0, and some additional spins, capital B sub I, are in some other set, sigma of B sub I. So these maps, OK. So the Hamiltonian looks like this. Remember, these were the first terms coming from H1. And here I have terms H21, H22, H23, H24. Okay. And so here, for example, my flux spin is 0. And my additional spin sigma B1 are in a certain set, capital sigma B1. So this will give me energy 0. In this case, I also have sigma B2 0, and this additional spins in this additional configuration, so this will also give me energy zero. But in this case, it is impossible to satisfy. So this term will for sure give me some non-zero energy. So in particular, I want to take a satisfying assignment sigma B1 sigma star within this set. And this I define the energy that this gives me as kappa I, which is certainly larger or equal than 1. And again, let me explain the role that this second faithful reduction is playing in the final Hamiltonian, which is that it gives the flux spin in state 1 the energy of the target model in that physical configuration. So the flux spin will say, this is the physical configuration, and I want to assign it the energy of the target model in that configuration. So in the final Hamiltonian, this will look like this. So I will have, this is the first term that we analyzed before, and I will have an H2 of I, depending on the flux spin and the additional spin. And I will divide over kappa I, which is the value that the Hamiltonian H2 gave me initially, and multiply by the energy of the original, of the target model. This is where it comes in. So this will look like this. So for I is different from 3, different from x, whatever x is. So x is the value of the physical spins here. I will get that the ground that they are in the ground that they're in the ground state. The flux spin is 0. The additional spins of A1 are in this set, and the additional spins of B1 are in this set. But for the I equals 3. So I equals x, this is our running example. It is impossible that they are in the ground state because sigma b1 is equal to 1. Therefore, I will pick in one particular model. One particular level, which will give me energy k sub I. And I will divide by k sub I and multiply by e sub I so that I get indeed e sub 3 here. And now what I need to do is to get rid of the rest of the levels, so that I can finally prove my result. So this is the role of this third faithful reduction, which forces the spins in bi to be in a certain configuration, sigma star bi, if sigma bi is equal to 1, and does nothing otherwise. So you can express this in this formula here, which is exactly what I just said. So this sigma bi must be 1, and sigma capital bi must be sigma capital bi star, or sigma bi is 0. Again, we reduce it to a Hamiltonian H3, which has 0 ground state energy if and only if this formula is satisfiable. We play the same game, where the satisfying assignment is mapped to a ground state energy configuration with some additional auxiliary variables in some state. And this finally looks something like this. So we have some additional auxiliary variables for each I. So remember, this is I1, I2, I3, I4, and so on. And we are fixing the novelty here is that we are fixing the state of all of these BIs to be in a certain state, sigma star of BI. So we're fixing this one. And of course, other non-satisfying assignments will correspond to excited state of H3. So this plays the role of fixing the spin configurations of the auxiliary spins Vi to be sigma star. So finally, we will have this third term will be multiplied by a delta. So we will have that only the states with sigma Bi equals to sigma Bi star will have a finite energy, and all the rest will have energy above delta. So essentially, okay, so, and for the i's, different from x, so in this case, different from 3, we have that they will contribute zero energy to the final Hamiltonian, and only, of course, the I equals to x, in this case I equals 3, will contribute an energy precisely E3 or EX to the final Hamiltonian. So what this is showing is that my Hamiltonian H okay, maybe this is a bit abusing notation. So my Hamiltonian H evaluated at sigma equals X and at many other sigmas, all these auxiliary variables, has energy E sub X, which is what I wanted to show. And moreover, all other states have energy above delta. So somehow this will really explain my entire low energy spectrum or my entire spectrum below delta. And of course, by construction, the configuration X is reproduced in a subset of the spins of H. And I just want to mention that our result also holds for partition functions. So in particular, it is not so obvious to see because a priori, each energy level may introduce a different degeneracy of the auxiliary spins, which may imply that the degeneracy of each energy level is different. So it is not obvious that the partition function of the target model is equal to the partition function of the complete model, universal model. However, one can modify this construction a little bit to make sure that this is the case. And I'm not showing it here because it looks a bit awkward, but it's just a modification of this idea. So, and this in particular implies that we recover previous so-called completeness results, which showed that the partition function of a certain model equals the partition function of any other model if we choose the parameters of the original model appropriately. But in those results, it was a bit strange because the complete model was found to be in each case very different and they were relying on very different proofs. So for example, it was shown to be the 2D Ising model with fields with imaginary couplings, or the 3D Ising model only for a restricted class of models, or the 4D Ising lattice gauge theory. So we somehow give an explanation, if you want, for these results. And our corollary that the 2D Ising model with fields is also complete somehow supersedes these previous results and shows it not only for the partition function, but also for the Hamiltonian. So with that, I would like to finish by saying this talk had one message, which is that a spin model is a universal Hamiltonian simulator if and only if there exists a faithful reduction from SAT to its ground state energy problem and it is closed, which meant that the sum of two Hamiltonians are also in the model. And this notion implies that the low energy physics can reproduce any other Hamiltonian or the physics of any other Hamiltonian. And as a corollary, we obtain that the 2D Ising model with fields has this property. So in its parameter regime, somehow it contains the physics of any other model in its low energy sector. And somehow as an outlook, I wonder if I suppose that we could design mappings on demand to devise somehow simpler simulation schemes. So instead of trying to prove this general result, to say I'm interested in simulating this Hamiltonian with this other Hamiltonian, can I produce a reduction which is as efficient as possible? And of course, it would be very interesting to generalize it to quantum Hamiltonians, but we don't really know how to do it at the moment. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Any questions for John? So there's something about the crossing gadget that you described that I wasn't totally clear about. So if I understood correctly in your example where you have some Hamiltonians in one of which A interacts with B and then the other of which A interacts with C, the idea to make it a planar model is to sort of duplicate A into two copies and then put it in an interaction that sort of forces them, puts a high penalty on them being different. Is that the right intuition?
So the idea is, imagine that you have a 2D model on two sets of spins, A and B. And this is defined on a 2D square lattice. And then you have a 2D model on two sets of spins, A and C. Okay, and then you take the sum of these sums. And this, in general, it might be it might result in an interaction pattern which is not allowed in your family of models. Then I was just saying for the 2D model, if this results in a non-planar graph, which is the more general thing that you can have, because they will be for sure two-body interactions, and so for sure you will be able to describe it with a graph, and this graph may be non-planar. So this is somehow the most general thing you can imagine. Then you can, in fact, simulate somehow this non-planar graph with a planar graph. So what I want to say is that there is a reduction from the problem of vertex cover to the problem of planar vertex cover, where in each crossing of the problem of vertex cover, a little gadget is introduced such that in its low energy physics, it reproduces this crossing. I don't know if I'm being very clear.
Is it the case that I replace a given vertex with a pair? So A becomes a pair of vertices, A1 and A2? Or
it's a bit complicated. I remember there were like 16 spins or something for each of these gadgets. And essentially, you're using the trick all the time that I was mentioning. So using the ferromagnetic Ising interaction to put very strong interactions between a pair of spins, which makes sure that you're in the low energy spectrum, somehow, these two spins will be in the same state. No, some two spins within this set of 16 spins. I remember maybe 16, 17, I don't know, something like that. You were using this trick repeatedly. I cannot say precisely these two spins or so, but this was essentially the trick. Maybe it's not such a natural condition, this closeness, but we need it for this proof, as I said, so that we need to say, if I simulate one term, and if I can simulate each term, then I will also be able to simulate the sum of the terms. Maybe one could improve on that. I don't know. The good thing about this is that you only need to know the spectrum of one term. Then you don't need to know the spectrum of the sum of the terms.
Any further questions? If not, then let's thank Gemma again.